Hello, and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests up today. First, in a little while, we'll hear from Michael Dorsey, professor of environmental studies at Wesleyan University, about the recent climate conference in Doha, Qatar. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from a frequent guest on Behind the News, Yiannis Varoufakis, reporting from Athens. He'll give us an update on, and a prognosis for, the interminable euro crisis. An apology by way of a technical note. I'm visiting the in-laws for this holiday week at the end of a dirt road in Massachusetts. The phone line is rather poor, so I recorded today's interviews using Skype. Sometimes Skype is very good. Sometimes, though, it drops out and garbles and isn't so good. Back to normal next week. I don't have the time today for the turn-of-the-year thumbsucker required by journalistic convention. I'll just say that while the economy remains grim for many and the climate outlook grimmer, I am feeling a strange attack of hopefulness as we approach 2013, numerical superstitions be damned. For all the many disappointments represented by Barack Obama, his re-election is an encouraging sign of some growing decency and maturity among the American electorate. As I've said before, most of his voters are signaling a desire for a more peaceful, more egalitarian world. They did that in 2008 and again in 2012. They're not getting it, but that they seem to want it is encouraging. And for a black guy with a funny name presiding over a crummy economy to win re-election by a convincing margin calms one's worst fears about the collective national mind. That, plus a growing social liberalism, same-sex marriage, marijuana legalization, and it's almost as if the USA is finally growing up. I hope there's more of this in 2013, though I'm sure the road ahead will not be bumpless. Okay, first up is Michael Dorsey. Michael is a visiting professor of environmental studies at Wesleyan University in Connecticut. He's been on Behind the News a couple of times, reporting on various UN climate conferences. Here he is to report on the one that occurred in Doha, Qatar, from November 26th through December 8th. The conference is one of a series launched 20 years ago with the signing of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change in 1992. You may have noticed that despite a lot of negotiations and protocols and communiques, not much has been done reversing the disastrous trajectory of the climate. Michael Dorsey will help us understand why. Welcome, Michael Dorsey. Doha. These UN things are mysterious to a lot of people, so tell us what this Doha conference is all about and what process it fits into.
Sure. The 18th Conference of the Parties, as its official title goes, just happened in Doha, Qatar, this late November and earlier this month, December 2012. And it was a conference essentially to do one big task, set the second commitment period of the Kyoto Protocol to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, and then hopefully inject higher ambition into these negotiations to get the planet on a firm, decisive footing to eliminate poisonous, noxious carbon dioxide. That's the key gas driving planetary warming and climate chaos that we see unfolding before our eyes.
And so we've done this, I think it's two or three times in the past, your roundup or reporting from these meetings, and they always seem a little disappointing. Any exception this time?
Absolutely not. Again, we saw the same lackluster, low-intensity democratic efforts from our ambassadors or special envoys, Stern and Pershing, appointed by the president. The low-intensity democratic ambitions essentially committed us to a second commitment period of the Kyoto Protocol that would stretch out into 2020. And they were really mired, the negotiations were particularly mired in a very lackluster politics of the possible in the midst of a global catastrophe unfolding.
We just had Superstorm Sandy, which concentrated a lot of minds in the New York metropolitan area, or at least I hope it did. Did that have any effect on American thinking or any thinking elsewhere, or are we just able to forget these as quickly as they happen?
You would think that the Superstorm Sandy did have effect, at least on the lead negotiators and our representatives at the climate negotiations in Doha. Nothing was apparent that it did. Again, the commitments were non-existent. The firm commitment to have real rules to regulate the end of fossil fuels was nowhere forthcoming. The commitment to draw on a seemingly endless, approaching mindless, aimless set of negotiations now out for essentially a decade to 2020 was in play. Nothing really substantive was laid down in Doha. And the reality is, as my colleague Michael Gerard, a professor up at Columbia in the law school, pointed out just a couple of weeks after the negotiations in Doha, with all due respect to those that suffered the brunt of the storm, Sandy in New York and in the tri-state area, Connecticut and New Jersey, Sandy was relatively mild, a Category 1 storm. And I think even though some politicians have now made it the case to talk about the new normal is catastrophic weather, the mildness of Sandy really pulled away the veil of the lack of resilience of a major metropolitan area like New York and reminded us of the gross lack of resilience of other metropolitan areas like New Orleans a few years ago with Katrina.
And to make a point that should be obvious, but I'm afraid isn't, Sandy also hit in the Caribbean, did a lot of damage there, didn't get anywhere near as much attention, and then just about a couple of weeks ago, the Philippines were hit by a really nasty storm. So the poor regions of the world are getting hammered.
That's absolutely the case. And a couple of weeks following the giant typhoon, the super typhoon that struck the Philippines, and before it came ashore in the Philippines, it ravaged Palau. A couple of weeks after that, another super typhoon struck the Pacific Island nation of Samoa. So we now live in a time of catastrophic storms. The super typhoons in the Pacific had maximum sustained winds of north of 150 miles an hour for not just a couple of hours, but for 6, 7, 8 hours all day long.
And I've gotten in the habit lately of saying climate change is no longer in the future. It's upon us.
It is indeed upon us. It is upon us in a most devastating and catastrophic way. It's upon us in a way that really means that those that have the least responsibility for the problem are hammered and harmed the most and devastated the most, while those that have the real burden of driving the problem are getting off scot-free. And we saw this painfully in the negotiations in Doha. We had students that had been leading the charge and injecting vigor and wherewithal into these negotiations by protesting and lobbying negotiators. We saw them variously restrained and kept out of the negotiation halls while the diplomats and the UN bureaucrats allowed in big oil and coal companies to lobby and agitate without so much as a wink or blink of the eye.
Well, I guess the coal companies and oil companies now have achieved some kind of NGO status in these negotiations, haven't they?
Well, indeed, all non-governmental entities operate under the banner of non-governmental organization, and that applies to the oil companies and coal companies and fossil fuel companies writ large. They exhibit a tremendous amount of power and influence in these negotiations. Not only do they offer a tremendous number of side events and, you know, wine and dine diplomats and delegates, but they push for new resources and new forms of, you know, monies and bailouts. And this was pretty much the case in Doha. Many of these fossil fuel companies, at least those that have their headquarters and operations in Europe, have variously invested in the broken and collapsed European Union emissions trading system. It used to be called the emissions trading scheme, as it was. Those companies have seen the price of carbon in Europe collapse to well below €1. And so they've been looking for bailouts, because they bought high and now the price is low, and so they're left holding the bag and looking for governments to bail them out. Fortunately, we didn't see governments make big commitments to move monies into the pockets of those dirty fossil fuel industries.
Now, this gets a little geeky, but why did the price of carbon collapse? Why is this EU scheme failing?
Well, the scheme is failing for a variety of reasons. Probably first and foremost is that the initial outlay of credits was larger. So the European Union allocated more credits than were needed, and that it aided and abetted the collapse of the price. Of course, once the credits were allocated and given away freely to companies, that was essentially a form of free money to companies. So companies, as they would, you know, similar to drug dealers and, you know, drug addicts, when they were given the free money by the European Union governments, they kept lobbying for more free money, and that kept the steady flow, the oversupply of credits into the system, causing the price to depress. But other things played into the failure of the system as well. Rampant fraud, the wholesale mismanagement of the clean development mechanism side of the marketplace, which allowed for paper projects to be constructed in the global south to inject questionable credits into the system. A variety of structural and process errors aided and abetted the collapse of the marketplace, much in addition to the lobbying efforts of those companies that were coked up and addicted to the free money that they began getting from the outset of the scheme.
Now, and some years ago, when we thought we might develop a cap-and-trade system here, that this was held up as a model, but now it's just out the door, right?
Well, oddly and sadly and disturbingly enough, the model still is held up as something that could work if given time, if paid attention to and coddled. Indeed, many of the architects of the European Union emissions trading system were pulled over into the hearings in California to see the turning on of the marketplace in California, which will officially turn on in just at the beginning of the year 2013.
So California is having its own statewide carbon trading scheme?
Indeed. They're right now in a kind of a preliminary phase of that marketplace that started in this past quarter, but they will officially inaugurate their marketplace at the first of the year 2013.
And what do you think how's it going to work out?
Well, right now we have some preliminary data that indicates that there's been false or accidental overbids by some of the companies. There are already some initial problems that indicate that the likelihood of that marketplace succeeding is indeed unlikely.
Well, yippee. So were there any good guys in Doha? Any countries at all taking the lead or saying at least good things?
Well, the only good guys were sadly being hammered. They were being hammered by the ravaging, unfolding climate catastrophe gripping the planet. We heard a tear-jerking, tearful plea from the environment minister of the Philippines. He was begging, literally begging with tears in his eyes, countries like the United States to get serious in these talks. We've continued to see, again, the strong, steadfast, courageous activism of young people, even though some of them were initially excluded and banned from the conference in the first week of the negotiations in Doha. We've seen, again, a tremendous growing movement of mainly led by social movements and civil society individuals demanding climate justice, but there it seems as if their demands, their cries, their literal tears and begging are falling on deaf ears, the deaf ears of laggard, lackluster diplomats like Envoy Stern and Envoy Pershing.
We're listening to Michael Dorsey, who's a visiting professor of environmental studies at Wesleyan. Of course, our country, responsible for something like a quarter of the world's emissions, less than 5% of the population. Do you talk to the delegates, or like off the record, are they worried or embarrassed by the public positions they have to take, or do they rationalize this somehow? What do they say and think?
Shockingly, the delegates, at least from the U.S., don't appear to be worried. More disturbingly, and to sort of, thumb their finger in the eye of delegates that beg them to take serious action, Ambassador Pershing, Jonathan Pershing, who co-leads the U.S. delegation, had the audacity to remind people that it was the U.S. that was footing the bill for some of the countries. No one reminded Ambassador Pershing that indeed it is the taxpayers that pay his salary. Perhaps he should recall these sorts of things when he's, being flip and reminding who's paying what bills. So it seems as if the callous, wayward, lackluster diplomacy of those in the State Department knows no bound. It's a sad day for America. We can do better. We have done better. We didn't put people on the moon with the politics of the possible. And that kind of morally bankrupt politics of the possible won't be the politics that will end the unfolding climate catastrophe.
Are there any business interests that could be brought to the side of the good guys? Some years ago, I remember the insurance industry, or there was an effort to bring them over because they're going to have to pay a lot of bills. Something to counterbalance the lobbying power of the carbon business. Is there anything along those lines that could happen?
Well, indeed, the insurance industry is still in the game. I wouldn't even say they had to be brought over. They were one of those what you might call early movers in the game, recognizing and having faith in science and being rooted in reality. They were simply looking at their books and recognizing that the increased number of intense storms with more frequency were you know, raiding their coffers because of the payouts that they had to make time and time again. So they have indeed been leading. We see some new efforts by some of the institutional finance guys who recognize that the fossil fuel industry is living on borrowed time. And eventually this is an industry that not only will we have to divest from, but undoubtedly we're going to have to dismantle before they destroy the planet.
And this Bill McKibben 350 divestment effort to get institutions to sell their carbon stocks, what do you make of that?
Well, it's a good beginning, but it's a small step, and we're going to need much larger, giant steps to really move the ball down the field, as it were. Divesting, I think, is a good beginning because it leverages and catalyzes the moral high ground and puts one's footing on that moral high ground, akin to the divestiture campaigns that helped end the situation in South Africa with apartheid. But we must remember, we must never forget that the thing that really nailed the last nails and the final nails into the sort of the heart of the evil apartheid machine, as it were, was the committed ground efforts of social movements of people that gave and lost their lives to see the end of that evil, awful regime. And it's that kind of resolve that we're going to have to see to not just divest out of oil, but to really dismantle the fossil fuel sector. And that's really what we're going to do. And that kind of activity is something that's beyond divestiture.
The psychology of climate change makes for real difficult politics, because if you look at this stuff really closely, it seems hopeless. Too late, we're done, the planet is cooked. Yet you need some degree of optimism and enthusiasm to get a political movement going. How do you resolve that contradiction?
Well, I don't think, at least from the urgency that I see in the young people and in students that come to these meetings and that have been protesting and lobbying delegates and representatives, both in the international negotiations as well as at home, that they are of the sort of grim and bleak outlook that there's nothing to do, we're cooked, we're going to go home and sit on our hands. They are indeed keeping up a fight that is inspiring for many people, inspiring for many delegates, inspiring for people both at home and in these international negotiations. And I think that if there's anyone we can look to, it's we can look to the urgency and the demands that young people are making and have been making really for years, and also the innovations that they're doing outside of these negotiations. The effort to think about divesting is something that has really evolved outside of the context of negotiations, but it's rooted in a sensibility of climate justice. It's rooted in the sensibility that says we've got three big things to do. We've got to keep oil in the soil, we've got to keep coal in the hole, and we've got to keep tar sands in the land, as it were. And maybe even add to that, we have got to keep gas, natural gas, under the grass as it is. That sort of mandate, that mantra, oil in the soil, coal in the hole, tar sands in the land, natural gas under the grass, that is really about not just dismantling the fossil fuel sector, dismantling dirty energy, but that's about delivering a new, green, intelligent future for the energy sector, as well as for future generations, as well as for the planet writ large.
Yet, as we speak, there's a shale oil and gas boom under the way of the United States, and you know they're bragging about surpassing Saudi Arabia in oil output by 2020. what do we do about this?
Well, there's a lot of unfortunate bragging and posturing by those in Washington and even at behind the desk of the president of the Oval Office. That bragging and posturing needs to be tempered a bit. And we need to see, and we're beginning to see this a little bit, social movements in the U.S., environmental groups and others beginning to keep up and increase the pressure on the White House and on the president to step out of the low-level, low-ambition politics of the possible and get out of the sort of reactionary, knee-jerk commitment to natural gas as a sort of transition fuel and really begin to think about how do we build that clean, green future that has nothing to do with second or third transition fuels, natural gas or otherwise. The fact of the matter is that the president needs to really get on board in a big, big way. The major emitters forum is basically limping along. The office that the president had on climate and energy was shuttered a couple years ago. There isn't yet the strong commitment at the level of the presidency to move this issue. And so that means that social movements in this second term are going to have to really hold the president's feet to the fire, as well as hold those that are responsible for representing our interests in these international negotiations, hold their feet to the fire as well.
Now, the EPA could do a lot if it wanted to, couldn't it? It has the legal authority to move against greenhouse gases.
Well, indeed they have. And in all fairness, that's something that the White House has pushed for. They've pushed for having the EPA tackle this problem, having carbon dioxide be considered as a pollutant. And also, in fairness, the president has done some modest work in terms of increasing the fuel efficiency standards of automobiles. But modesty is insufficient when we are faced with the catastrophic effects of unfolding climate crisis that we're seeing affect the U.S., affect livelihoods and lives, affect countries around the world. The politics of the possible, definitely not enough.
So what could we do? I mean, what would be a basic agenda to get started in the right direction on the right scale?
Well, let's come up with a commission on climate change. Let's begin a conversation about keeping oil in the soil. Let's move it from a mantra to moving to a phase out and a corresponding ramp up, at least in terms of the monies. If we want to be modest, as the president seems he likes and wants to be, let's be modest about moving money out of the fossil fuel sector. Let's be modest about ending those subsidies and moving those monies that we put into fossil fuels, that we put into oil and gas and coal, moving those into solar and wind and other renewables. That's on the modest scale. A more ambitious plan really phases out the extraction of oil. And it's something that we can do. Countries have been thinking about this. Sweden, even in OPEC, even OPEC countries are now beginning to take up seriously the idea that we should phase out of oil. And that's in part why the folks in Qatar stepped up and said, we want to have the climate convention here in Doha. Now, there are a lot of politics with the natural gas state of Qatar. But the fact is that even in the most unlikely places, like within OPEC, the conversation is beginning to happen about how do we need to move away from oil. That same kind of conversation with that level of serious ambition needs to grip the mind of this president. And if it doesn't, he'll go down as the president who didn't move to get out ahead of this problem.
Of course, there's the problem of Congress, which is, you know, nowhere near as lightened as the folks in Qatar.
Well, you know, sadly, it seems the case that we have some derelict Congress folks out there. We have the continued lunatic offerings of Inhofe from Oklahoma and others that are still clinging to the sort of sickly idea that science and reality don't exist and climate change, according, is some kind of myth. But I think that that is a distraction. It's not even really worthy of mentioning and discussing because the reality is that you've got some new people coming into Congress that I think are going to be pushing us forward. Elizabeth Warren and so forth really aren't caught up in that lunatic activity, that fringe behavior from the simple-minded, from places that we need not even mention.
And finally, we don't really need technological breakthroughs to get a meaningful start on this, right? We have the technology. We could do it if we wanted to.
It's about the politics. The technology has been on scene for now decades. We can do this if we want to do it. And indeed, it's going to be the politics of people and moving those both in the Congress and in the White House to get out ahead and to act like Americans and to be serious and to be forward-thinking and to be ambitious. That's what America's about. That's what it's been built on, and that's what it's going to be built on, independent of those lunatic fringe activists in Congress and independent of the lackluster activity that we've seen coming out of the Oval Office.
That was Michael Dorsey, who's a visiting professor of environmental studies at Wesleyan University in Connecticut. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break.
Many mothers sighing. News had just come over. We had 5 years left crying. News guy wept and told us Earth was really dying. Cried so much his face was wet. Then I knew. was not lying. I heard telephone, opera house, favorite melodies. I saw boys, toys, electric irons and TVs. My brain hurt like a warehouse, it had no room to spare. I had to cram so many things to store everything in there. And all the fat, skinny people.
A son of David Bowie, doing 5 years from Ziggy Stardust. I hope we have more than five. Next up is Yanis Varoufakis. Yanis is making his 12th appearance of Behind the News. Professor of economics at the University of Athens, Yanis has been driven to find work in the U.S. because of the economic crisis in his home country. He's a consulting economist at Valve Software, a video game maker based in Seattle, and will soon be a visiting professor at the University of Texas, Austin. Apologies for the audio quality during the first 5 minutes of this interview. As I said at the opening of the show, I had to use Skype to record this week's interviews, and the computer-to-computer connection with Athens was very poor. I switched to Skype to phone for the rest of the interview, and it was much, much better. Yanis Varoufakis. Welcome, Yanis. So you're back at Athens. What's it looking like?
It's looking pretty grim, Doug. It's looking melancholy. I hadn't been here since September, just walking down the street, one notices more boarded up shops, people looking more glum and irritable. This is the feeling that you get on the ground. If you look at the macro data, it confirms the picture of social economy, which continues to be in a tailspin without end.
Do you feel this in day-to-day interactions with people? They seem stressed and depressed?
Oh, utterly. It is impossible to hold a conversation with anyone which does not revolve around the catastrophe, as we call it. Everybody keeps, you know, especially if they know that one has an economic background, it is the only conversation to be had. What do I think the developments in Europe and global economy will be, whether there's any ray of light at the end of the tunnel? Then they relate to you their own personal tales of woe about crisis of real estate. They really need to sell off properties simply because they can't pay the property taxes on them. They're collapsing businesses, the fact that if their wages have gone through the floor, that is the topic of conversation.
There were some spirited demonstrations months ago, but what about the political realm? Are people resisting, or have they just kind of given up and resigned?
It's manic depression. One moment they're enraged, and you may fill the streets with, ugly and angry demonstrations. But then most of the time they're catatonic, and they privatize their own private crisis. Stay at home, licking their wounds.
And the government is just going along with what their masters up north say?
Indeed. Well, look, this is a government which was elected on a platform of a very simple policy, which I call model prisoners, of trying to appease the powers that be in Berlin and Brussels and Frankfurt, and to show that Greece can be a good prisoner that does as he or she is told, whatever idiotic rescue plans are conjured up in Brussels or Frankfurt, the Greek government signs of the dotted line. But let me share some private, if I may say this, information with you. I speak with people, quite high up in the government, including ministers, and when the microphones are switched off and the cameras are not around, they look just as terrified as every other Greek, telling me that despite the great pronouncements of the turnaround around the corner, that they can't see where the growth that Greece needs so badly is going to come from. One minister said to me the other day that we only have 3 or 4 months unless Europe changes its tune.
So there's no sign of a bottom, right? Not even a positive second derivative?
Well, the government claims that there is, at least in public. But I can't possibly see where there will be, you know, where the hope for such a second derivative comes from. Because, look, the facts are very stark and very simple. We have an economy which is in its fifth or sixth year of recession. The recession is savage. We're talking about -7%. We have a banking sector which doesn't operate as a banking sector. Banks cannot borrow. They cannot lend. So they don't effectively, they don't operate as banks. All they do is they give you deposits, if you have them, courtesy of the European Central Bank. And when you have such an imploding social economy with the industrial production index falling 10%, 15% every year for 5 years, and on top of that, you have immense fiscal consolidation, a squeeze, austerity, to the tune of additional measures of extra taxes and reductions in government expenditure of 12 billion only in the year to come, in 2013, in an economy which has shrunk to about 180 billion in terms of GDP, you realize what you're having is a self-enforcing recession, and I can't see the end of it under the present set of policies and circumstances.
Does the government have a strategy in its back pocket, or just to follow through the model prisoner thing and hope to get released on good behavior at some point?
It's entirely that. It's the hope that something which is going to change the tide within the Eurozone is going to take place before the federal election in Germany in 2013, which will allow some respite to come the way of Greece. And hanging on for dear life, no, there's absolutely no plan B. There's no long-term planning. For 3 years now, despite which government you have, this is the third government since the crisis began in May 2010, the plan is let's get the next tranche of loans and hope for the best.
And what about across the southern tier to your west, Italy, Spain, how are they faring?
Oh, this is the great, great tragedy of the Eurozone. Spain is already going the way of Greece. So you have a massive increase in unemployment, especially youth unemployment, as you know very well. But at the same time, you have all the elements of the multiple self-perpetuating, self-reinforcing crisis. You have house prices that are collapsing, and you in the United States know exactly what that means, especially when the banking system is so reliant on real estate collateral. You have the banks that have huge black holes in their books, and you have an insolvent state. In addition to that, you have ethnic tension between Catalonia and central Spain. There are all the hallmarks of a major, major capital C crisis in Spain. Italy is slightly better off, but its fate is utterly intertwined with that of Spain. What has happened during 2012, since this is the end of the year, we might as well look back on the whole year, is that the European Central Bank, which is the equivalent of the Fed here in the Eurozone, has taken two very decisive steps, one at the beginning of the year, 2012, and one very recently. The first step was effectively to print $1 trillion or euros and give it to the banks, which has stemmed the domino effect in the banking system, effectively, especially in Italy and in Spain. And the second thing that happened was it began in August when the chairman, the president of the European Central Bank, spoke for the first time about a very serious possibility of the disintegration of the Eurozone and promised, if need be, to do all it takes to stem that catastrophe. In particular, he promised to buy in the secondary markets Italian and Spanish bonds, Italian and Spanish state debt, in whatever quantities is necessary in order to stabilize those states. So that in itself, even though it's a phantom program, it has never happened. Unlike quantitative easing in the United States, the European Central Bank has not done that. But it has promised to do it if necessary. Just that announcement managed to reduce the pressure on the Italian and Spanish banks without changing anything of the architecture of the debt crisis and the banking crisis in those countries. So effectively, these countries have been put on ice, so the disease is slowing down in the fabric of the social economy of Italy and Spain, without, of course, having been reversed, because no real cure has been applied. So they're going the way of Greece, but much more slowly, which is a good thing in one sense, a bad thing in another. It's a good thing because the crisis is not unfolding as quickly as one would have expected. But on the other hand, by not having resolved anything of the essential weaknesses and real causes of the crisis in Italy and Spain, the Italian and Spanish societies are slowly and steadily descending into the abyss.
But the bond market is looking, I'm just looking at the interest rates. You've got Greek interest rates, 10-year bonds at 11.3, Italians 4.5, Spanish a little over 5. These are not panic levels of interest rates. Is the bond market being complacent, or is it the ECB that's just calmed their worries?
There are two different stories here. One concerns Greece. Well, effectively, all Greek debt, if not all, most of it, has been transferred from the private sector onto the European taxpayers. So for 3 years now, the European Union with the International Monetary Fund have been conspiring to ensure that all the banking losses and all the potential losses of the private sector caused by a Greek bankruptcy have been shifted off from the private sector onto the public sector, a typical bailout situation, which means that now whoever remains holding Greek government bonds can be more or less reassured that they don't have a problem with that, since all the burden has been shifted onto the German taxpayer primarily. Now, regarding Italy and Spain and their bonds, their yields, as you said quite rightly, they're quite high. They're very high these days. You know, 3 and 4 and 5% is very high interest rates to be paying in this economy. But nevertheless, they're not the 6 and 7% we had last year. And that's because of the announcement by Mr. Mario Draghi, the president of the ECB that I referred to. Now, this doesn't change the fact that the Spanish and Italian state debts are unsustainable, because when you have these economies in a recession, when you have -1, -2% growth, and you have 3 and 4% interest rates, you have the mountain of debt, which is very large, 3 trillion euros between them, growing at 3%, when the income from which these debts will have to be repaid is shrinking at 1 or 2, -1, -2%. So that effectively guarantees that the crisis will be back with us when the bond markets no longer believe the European Central Bank, or when they want to see the European Central Bank not just announcing that it will act, but, you know, expect the ECB to actually act. And the problem with this is that the ECB announced it's going to act, but it has created, it has put in place a condition for acting, which the political forces in Italy and Spain will find very, very hard to fulfill. So there is a game being played between governments, the ECB, and markets. So far, it is under control, but there is no guarantee. Actually, in my book, there is little hope that this is not going to spill over into a new escalation of the Eurozone crisis.
We're listening to the economist Yanis Varoufakis reporting from Athens. And any further progress in trying to understand what the Germans are trying to do, what their goal is, the Germans and their like junior partners in austerity like the Dutch, what's their end game? Can't they see this all unraveling and not even succeeding on its own terms, or do they have some motivations we can't divine?
Well, you know, Occam's razor, the simplest explanations are usually, not always, but usually the best. Mrs. Merkel is facing an election in September 2013. Mrs. Merkel wants to present to the German public an image, which has, she has presented very successfully so far, of a chancellor who is steadfast, who is not going to take on, you know, the German state's books, other people's debt more than it has to, that it will be very, very harsh towards the peripheral states, blaming deficit countries for their deficits. She does not want to tell the German electorate the truth about the state of the German banks. She does not want to tell them about the very simple fact, logical thought, she doesn't want to share it with them, that Germany cannot hope to continue having a surplus with the rest of the European periphery without the European periphery having a deficit with regard to Germany. So effectively, she wants to put a hold on everything. And I think it's quite instructive to see her attitude, Mrs. Merkel's attitude towards the Greek government. Effectively, what she's asked them to do is to pass all the bills that she's insisting that they should pass, austerity and so on. Privately, she tells them she knows it's not going to work, and this is simply going to reinforce the crisis and will create new deficits in the future. But she wants them to keep doing this and not to rock the boat until she wins the next federal election in September of 2013.
So in the meanwhile, many people must suffer over the next 9 or 10 months, and the risk of Europe flying completely apart is always present, just to assure her re-election.
It is, in my view, the case that the probability of disintegration is actually increasing, because the more you allow this crisis to persevere and to accelerate without dealing with it and dealing with its causes, but instead dealing with its symptoms, the worse things become. It is a tragedy that short-termism in politics has been added to the short-termisms of the European corporate and banking sector. And the conflation of the two kinds of short-termism are quite detrimental to Europe. And Europe is now in a recession that it didn't need to have. It's a completely unnecessary recession, which is a result of a spectacular political coordination failure problem.
I can understand how Merkel's austere homilies might appeal to the German public, but German industry and finance must at least have some understanding of how self-defeating this strategy is. Do they understand? Am I making a mistake? Or do they not have the political power to get their way? What's going on?
It is, I think, quite crucial to understand the conflict between German finance and German industry. German finance is doing very well, thank you, out of this Eurozone crisis. Because the more this Eurozone crisis is proceeding, the greater the flight of capital from the rest of Europe into Germany's banks. And that flight of capital into Deutsche Bank, into Finance Bank, all the banks in Germany, is helping German bankers mask the black holes that they have as a result of very silly lending practices of the past. So German finance, in Frankfurt in particular, is applaud all the way to the bank, if you excuse the pun, Mrs. Merkel's Australian policies in Europe. Now, German industry is in a different situation. German industry is exceptionally jittery about what is going on. We've had a serious reduction in industrial production, and German industry is not very happy about it, but on the other hand, they don't have the political kudos and clout that Frankfurt have in putting up a fight.
Okay, so now we're at the turn of the year, and so we engage in this debased journalistic practice of speculating about the future. I mean, does 2013 hold more of the same for Europe, or will something finally break in a positive or negative sense?
I think that the powers that be in Europe will try to keep the ship steady as she goes until September. The European Central Bank is going to continue to provide liquidity. And I think the key question is whether the financial markets are going to cotton on to what's going on in the realm of European industry and the shrinking sectors that so far, in the past decades and centuries even, have kept Europe strong. Is there going to be a rupture between finance and manufacturing? That is, for me, the great question. It is impossible to know. And it is impossible to know because the machinations of the European Central Bank are utterly political. They are not analytic. They're not natural phenomena that one can predict. Whether Mr. Asmussen, for instance, who is the German representative on the executive board of the European Central Bank, is going to clash with Mr. Weidmann, who is the head of the Bundesbank, the representative of the Central Bank of Germany to the European Central Bank, is going to play a very significant role in that, and it's a game of two apparatchiks, two functionaries that no one can second guess. My estimation is that we're simply going to have a deeper recession in Europe, and there will be some major changes in the way that the Eurozone crisis is being dealt with after September.
And then at the popular level, are you surprised by the lack of a more vigorous popular response, you know, of a broadly left direction? Does this kind of just seems like surrender and resignation by much of the suffering populations of Southern Europe?
Doug, as we know, and we've known this now since the 1930s, the moment, the period of time when the crisis is deepening is not a revolutionary moment in history. People, as we were saying earlier, especially regarding Greece and Spain, are privatizing their sorrows and licking their wounds. The other exceptionally significant aspect of your question concerns social democratic parties. You see, it is my view that over the period between 1980, 82, 85, and 2008, the great financial crisis, European social democracy sold its soul to the financial sector. Not always with bad intentions, a bit like Faust, who didn't necessarily have terrible intentions when he was lending or hiring or leasing his soul to the Mephistopheles. They thought that by allowing bankers to run rampant and create a great deal of private money, they could get a cut, not for themselves, but on behalf of the welfare state. So if you look at Tony Blair's government, he went all in with the City of London and used part of the proceeds that he received from taxing the rivers of cash that the city was creating in order to fund the National Health Service and so on, the welfare state. So as long as Wall Street, the City of London, and Frankfurt were producing oodles of money, the Social Democrats were quite happy to let them get on with it, as long as they could get a piece of the action and use it in order to fund the welfare state. But now, in 2008, when the whole edifice of the financial sector collapsed, they were already in the pockets of the bankers and the Social Democrats, and they had given up the analytical and moral tools by which they could subject the bankers to critical scrutiny and political pressure. So they caved in, and you saw socialist governments like the ones in Greece effectively being dictated to by the bankrupt bankers, similarly in Spain. So the point I'm trying to make here is that the social democratic left, which was the large pool of political capital that could be used in order to create a movement against austerity, has been depleted and expended and completely divided.
And finally, this sounds like a situation that would benefit the far right. Certainly Golden Dawn in Greece was making some progress. How are they doing?
Unfortunately, tragically, catastrophically, they're doing exceptionally well. And remember, this is not a neo-Nazi party. This is a Nazi party, a party that has a swastika or a version of it as its symbol, a party that preaches violence against migrants and against anyone that disagrees with them, a party that is closed in black shirts, and they are winning, I hate to say, the struggle on the pavement and on the streets, on main streets and back alleys, because they are using typical Nazi propaganda in order to admonish the bankers on the one hand and wrap up in their criticism and malicious hatred with the bankers, the foreigners, the Pakistanis, the Jews, the lefties. And because they have this momentum that the left has given up on, simply because it allowed itself to a very large extent either to become marginalized or to go into bed with the bankers, you know, they don't have an opposition on the streets of Athens and of Madrid and of Andalusia. See, people are so angry with the political regime, the political establishment, both of the right and of the center-left. So now the Nazis effectively have a free hand.
That's not a bright note to begin the new year on, is it?
Indeed it isn't.
That was economist Yanis Varoufakis reporting from Athens on the economic crisis in Europe. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go with this, a real New Year's cliche, which doesn't make it any less one of the glories of human life. A bit of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, performed by the Berlin Philharmonic under Herbert von Karajan. Have a good rest of holiday season. Until next year, bye.